I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to a bonus episode of Cinematic Universe, the podcast that's all about comic book movies, brought to you by FilmDivider.com. I'm your host, Joe Cunningham, and joining me this week is...
James Hunt.
This bonus episode arrives in the spot that our Age of Ultron podcast would have occupied, but as we brought you that one early, we had a space to fill, and we thought, what better than a bonus episode focused on Netflix's Daredevil? And then we realised we could do better. And that better comes in the form of a short interview with Charlie Cox, which will precede our Daredevil discussion. It's all very exciting. But before any of that, we've got yet another very special announcement. If you listen to our Avengers Age of Ultron podcast, you'll know that Seb is taking a podcast sabbatical due to his family expecting a new arrival. And while we are very sad that Seb is not with us here today, we're delighted to announce that Seb's daughter Lois was born on Sunday, which we're sure you'll agree is a truly super name, super being the operative word, and we are thrilled for him and his family. James and I will be back very shortly to discuss season one of Daredevil, but first here's my interview with Charlie Cox, which took place last week shortly after the news that Daredevil would be returning for a second season in 2016.
Well, first of all, I guess congratulations on season two.
Thank you so much.
So we're seeing that in 2016.
Yes, I imagine so, yeah.
Do you know yet where that's going to fall in kind of the whole Defenders build-up? Is it going to be like...
I don't. I presume that, because I imagine we'll be shooting that very soon. Mm. We'll probably go into production in June, July of this year. So it'd be unlikely, there's no way that I could do Defenders before then.
Yes, yeah.
So it'd be, the likelihood is that that Daredevil 2 will come up before Defenders, but you never know, they could hold it.
And was it something that when you signed up for the first season, were you contracted for future seasons as well as Defenders? Was all that options?
Yeah, but that's very common. So I didn't assume that guaranteed any further seasons. Mm. In fact, I wasn't even sure if they intended to do further seasons because they've got such a big commitment with the Netflix Marvel collaboration, being the first four and then the Defenders. So I was, when it was even being discussed or there were whispers of a second season, I was very excited. I also think having worked on the first season and witnessed what that storyline is and how Daredevil kind of evolves into Matt Murdock evolves into Daredevil and how long we took with that journey. I think I felt like it's going to be valid to have a season where you really get to live with Daredevil in his full persona before you meet the Defenders.
Yeah, and has there been any talk? Do you know, like, is it going to be a fresh original story? Is it going to be something from the comics? You know, is there already plans?
No, they haven't. All I know is that we're going to do a second season.
Yeah.
You know, that's the only thing that they've discussed. Obviously, I mean, I don't even know whether there'll be a new villain or whether Wilson Fisk will reappear.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
That must have been really fun acting.
Yeah,
he's
great. D'Onofrio. He's extraordinary.
It's kind of some of the best scenes in the show, where like when you meet in the art gallery. It's fantastic.
Yeah. And, I remember when I read... episode 6, and me and Nico the actor who played Vladimir, we're in that basement, and then you hear that voice, and you don't know where it's coming from, on the, and it turns out to be on the, on the walkie-talkie. I remember that's great writing. Brilliant.
I'm wondering, what kind of research did you do beforehand? Did Marvel come to you and Netflix come to you and go, here is a stack of Daredevil comics?
They give me a Marvel Unlimited account, which is one of the great perks of being in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And so, I read a lot of comics, and I really kind of like wanted to find the different writers and illustrators and issues that best represented the show that was that was being written.
It seemed to be very Frank Miller influenced. Like bits from all over, but
yeah, a lot of Frank Miller. Obviously, the costume, the first black ninja costume is taken from the Man Without Fear, the John Romita Jr. Illustration, but also I spent a lot of time reading the Bendis Malieve stuff. Yeah. Tonally, I think that feels very spot on for the show we were trying to make. It's very kind of dark. It's very kind of lonely, and it's a very ashamed, world with a lot of criminal activity going on, and a city that's infected with dodgy behavior. And so, as I say, that really fitted in with the kind of show that was the scripts that were coming to me. So yeah. I concentrated on them quite a lot. Yeah.
On our show, you do a thing. I am mostly kind of like movie TV based, but I've got two co-hosts who are really comic book focused. Okay. So every time after we watch a property, they go like, here are the comics you should follow up by reading.
Okay, great. Oh, that's
so
very cool.
Having now finished the first season of Daredevil, what would you recommend that I read from?
So if you've never read anything.
I've read The Man Without Fear and Born Again.
Okay, so, great. So two brilliant ones. You've got to read Man Without Fear. I also encourage people to watch Frank Miller's first run at Daredevil in the 70s, which was, I think it was 70s. Oh, God, I better check that. But that he did with Klaus Janson. Yeah. That's a really, really good series. And the first two episodes, Daredevil comes into Peter Parker's world, and then we go off with Daredevil, and we meet, some of the great characters and etc. Everything that Bendis Malieve did together. Another one of my favorites is End of Days, which was Bendis Mac, and Malieve was involved in that as well. So some really, really cool issues there.
Okay, and so just one final question: if Daredevil was going to show up in one Marvel Phase 3 movie, which one would you like it to be? Which character would you like Daredevil to spend time with? Is it Spider-Man?
And obviously Daredevil has a history with Black Widow, and I'd love to see that. Would be an interesting dynamic, not just because Scarlett Johansson plays the part, but but I think I'd love to see what that dynamic is. And I think they're quite similar in terms of the energies that they bring to the group.
Yeah,
I think we're quite similar. So I'd be very interested to see what that dynamic is.
Well, you'd have to fight the Hulk for her.
Yeah. In the past, that's not gone well. Yeah.
No. Yeah. Thanks so much for speaking to me, and congratulations. I've loved the first season.
Oh, awesome.
So, yeah.
Thank you so much.
Well, let's kick off now our spoiler-filled discussion of all 13 episodes of season 1 of Daredevil. So that was Charlie Cox, who is a thoroughly lovely man, but now we'll get down to the business of discussing him and his show. After being so nice to him to his face, I'm about to tear his performance to pieces. Now, let's start by talking about Charlie Cox, James. Are you with me? Did you think he was a really pretty damn good Daredevil?
Yeah, he's got the demeanour of Matt Murdock in that he doesn't overplay it, but at the same time you can sense that he knows more than he lets on.
I liked that at the start you got the sense of him being, slightly cheeky, his like wry sense of humour, and there'd be gags about him always knowing when there's a pretty woman in the room and being drawn to these damaged but attractive women, so stay away from Karen Page, basically.
Yeah, like he doesn't, even though he has a disability, he doesn't let that define him. Like, he's got, other traits around him, and that I think Charlie Cox's performance sort of reflects that he is more than just the blind guy.
As the show goes forward, there is a lot, I felt anyway, like there was a lot more Daredevil than there was Matt Murdock. And not necessarily that he's always in the costume, but when he is Matt Murdock, he's focused on Daredevil things. This isn't a show that digs into the lawyering side of Matt or his private life. It's mostly him and his superhero plight.
Yeah, it gets quite intense towards the end as well, doesn't it? Like, it definitely, the wars between the two characters, or the two sides of the character, break down pretty much completely. completely by the end of the series.
Mm. I could imagine, you know, when it comes back for a season two, that wouldn't necessarily have to be the case at that point. It kind of felt like an arc, a season-long arc of 13 hours of him slowly becoming Daredevil. And it takes him defeating Wilson Fisk at the end to kind of be comfortable that guy, that alter ego, is fully formed.
It's the bit where he stands on the building at the very end. Like, that's the first time he's been actively looking for Daredevil work, isn't it? Like, every other time he's thought, well, now I have to get into the costume and beat some people up. But that time he's preemptively in the costume and he's ready to go.
About that costume.
Such a shame, isn't it?
It's just not very good. I mean, when it leaked online before the season actually started, the day before, you know, I was chatting to one of our mutual friends, Reese, and he was saying, oh, what do you think of the costume? And I was like, I'm going to wait to see it in context. I'm not going to rush to any judgment based on, you know, an out of context still.
Yeah.
And then you get to episode 13 and you see it in context and you go, it's not very good. And it's not like it just like a couple of basic things. Like, it didn't red enough. It didn't feel red enough to be like recognizably Daredevil. Mm-hmm. And the fact that there are eye holes in the costume, like, what? He's Daredevil. Why are there? I'm doing the thing now where I'm going, this isn't the thing that I know from the comics.
The weird thing is, having eye holes actually makes it less convenient because it makes it very obvious that Daredevil is blind.
When he's wearing his black cloth over his eyes, no one assumes he's blind. So yeah, you would imagine just having eye holes leaves him slightly more vulnerable and also slightly more identifiable.
Mm-hmm. My problem personally with the costume was that it actively undermines the tone of the rest of the series. You know, you have that fight where he's getting hit with bars and there's sparks flying off him and stuff, and it's just suddenly the tone of the series goes from like ultra grit realistic to like Power Rangers basically, and it looks like someone's wearing a homemade Christopher Nolan Batman costume.
Like I said, it would be quite nice if he was wearing a costume that offered him more protection, so that maybe when someone is swinging knives at him, it's not slashing him to pieces, but at the same time that it's not just ching.
Yeah.
And he's okay.
I mean, also, there's the kind of weird beat as well where Melvin Potter's saying to Daredevil, you know, the red bits protect you from knives and the black bits are bulletproof.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, he can't see colour. He doesn't know what you're saying. Like, that was that, you know, I know Melvin Potter might not know Daredevil is blind, but I got the feeling that line was aimed at the audience rather than the character.
Yeah. And then just briefly on the depiction of Daredevil's powers. Because I was thinking about this. I'm not sure in any of the comics that I've read that I've ever seen much visualization of his powers. I think there might be a bit in Man Without Fear, but obviously the 2003 movie made quite a big deal of visualizing Daredevil's world. Do we just get that one scene where we see his world on fire in this?
In this series, yeah, there's only the one. I mean, it's interesting because when Mark Waid took over the comics a few years ago, he kind of came up with a sort of new direction for Daredevil, and that included a new visual style from, I think it was Marcos Martin, who basically started doing what they do in the films and like giving you Daredevil's world in sort of a blank radar sense. You know, visual. And I genuinely expected to see it a lot more in this series.
Yeah, but the show really took its time about the powers in general anyway. I mean, I think it was three or four episodes in before, there was a recognition that, yes, these are superpowers he has. He's not actually just awesome at stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's largely not touched upon. It's kind of, I liked that stuff in the early episodes. It was just, look, we trust our audience. Maybe you've never read or seen any Daredevil before, but you can kind of get this. He's a blind guy, but he can do awesome stuff. You know, we'll give you some explanation at some point, but for now, just appreciate the character, appreciate the storytelling, and appreciate the adventures that he's on.
But, yeah, I mean, you compare it to the 2003 film where they say something like, there's literally a line where Ben Affleck says something along the lines of, my enhanced sense of touch gives me super strength, and it's like, does it? How does it?
Yeah, I kind of appreciate that. Man Without Fear is a very obvious inspiration for this show, and generally it felt like the tone was very, very Frank Miller-ish to me, which is something I, you know, mentioned to Charlie Cox in that interview. But did you see flashes from other, you know, flash of inspiration from other places in the Daredevil comics?
Honestly, it was very sparse compared to like the sheer density of material they lifted from Frank Miller's run, down to incidental characters were named for like thugs and stuff who turned up in Frank Miller's run. If no more Daredevil had been written other than Frank Miller's, I feel like they could still have made this TV program.
That seemed to permeate its way into the tone as well. It's a very, I didn't feel like it was like oppressively grimdark. I think that would have been my biggest fear of this, that it would just have been like overwhelmingly unpleasant. I think a lot of it comes down to the performances, that there is nuance and there is ideas in this show rather than just, this is a dark and gritty show.
Yeah.
Did you enjoy Christopher Nolan's Batman? Then we've coloured it in the same way.
It does. It feels like an adult show rather than a sort of violent one. Because like, you kind of get shows that use a lot of violence and really they're aimed at sort of angry teenagers more than grown-ups. But this, I mean, in the early episode, Foggy was definitely saving the programme from being too po-faced. But generally, I think they set out to make something that adults would like and that couldn't be watched by children. And I think in that regard, they succeeded.
Very early on, when you were writing one of your like episode recaps for Den of Geek, and you asked the question whether the violence was justified or whether it had a purpose.
That particular piece I wrote came just after I had watched the episode 4, I think. So, like, episode 2 has an exposed bone in when the guy's arm gets broken in the bowling alley. Episode 3 has a spike coming out the back of someone's head, and episode 4 ends with someone's head being squashed in a car door.
And in fact, I think the bowling alley and the spike are both episode 3, aren't they? I think the thing that happens in episode 2 that I was particularly perturbed by was the moment where he is interrogating the guy with Rosario Dawson.
Yeah, and he's got the knife.
Yeah, and he sticks the knife into a like strategically placed nerve in someone's eye.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm not sure whether I needed to see that. But having said that, one of the things that I really did appreciate about the violence, and it's something that, you know, this is a problem I have with cinema and, you know, movie classifications in general, is that you can show as much bloodless violence as you want and get like a 12A rating. And as soon as you show blood or gore, it's like, oh, 15, 18, whatever. I don't understand why violence without consequence is something that's more acceptable than violence with consequence.
Well,
and what I really appreciated about this show, I think a couple of early examples aside, like I think like the guy shoving his head on the spike, yes, it's grim and it's nasty, but it serves a narrative point. Like, he would rather have that happen to him than face the Kingpin.
Just from a sort of storytelling perspective, the idea was to show us how surprised and shocked Matt was that
yes.
would happen.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's why they showed us the full, you know, the full
Matt
horror.
Reacts like the audience reacts.
Yeah, like that I can deal with.
And the violence that does happen, to go back to that theme of like actually seeing the effects of violence. You know, when Matt Murdock as Daredevil is injured and severely injured, you see the effects of that for 3 or 4 episodes afterwards. He's mm-hmm. running around holding his ribs or like nursing a stab wound.
He's not Captain America with a bleeding lip for the rest of the scene that disappears immediately afterwards.
Yeah, there is tangible effects of violence, and I liked that the show stuck with that throughout. And speaking of one of the early very violent, very grim scenes that again I think has a very specific narrative point is Vincent D'Onofrio's Kingpin slamming someone's head repeatedly with a car door until it bursts.
Basically, I remember a lot of chunks falling off, and that was what disturbed me.
But let's talk about Kingpin. Let's talk about Vincent D'Onofrio's
Kingpin.
Ah, he's
so good.
I love Charlie Cox in this show. I was a Charlie Cox fan going in and continue to be. But D'Onofrio is something else. He is. And after settling on this show for a couple of weeks, I can fairly confidently say he is the best villain in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Loki is great, but Kingpin's got the edge. He's just fantastic.
The thing I like so much about the performance is how much nuance there is in there. Because if you look back again at the 2003 Daredevil, like Michael Clarke Duncan is playing it like straight down the line, like he is just a rich bastard, basically.
Yeah, and Duncan's great, but he's playing the part that's written on the page. And
yeah, yeah.
That is not this Kingpin. This Kingpin is a guy who truly believes what he's doing. And I keep coming back to the line. It was in one of the first trailers for the show, but it was like something like, just because you're fighting villains doesn't make you the hero.
Yeah.
And you get the sense where both Daredevil and Kingpin, you know, they're fighting to make their city a better place. And each of them kind of embraces their position in that towards the end.
Mm-hmm.
Again, to go back to another Charlie Cox show, Boardwalk Empire, it's this great line in the first episode where someone says to Nucky, you can't be half a gangster. And the payoff at the end of the second season is when he makes a horrible, horrific choice because he knows he can't be half a gangster anymore. He has to fully embrace the gangster life. And we get that arc with Kingpin, but we also get all of these lovely little character moments all the way through. It's such a specific performance. And the way he interacts with characters like Wesley, but most importantly, Vanessa really elevates him to another level.
The thing I like about his performance is that it's, you get the sense that he is, at heart, he is just a ruthless thug, and he's trying his very best in every scene to be on his, you know, on his best behavior. He could crush the life out of you with his hands, and he wants to, but he knows it's probably not a good idea for that. And then you get those moments where he really, you know, he's got the impetus to do that sort of thing. And the grin he has on his face when he's beating up Daredevil the first time fight.
Yeah.
It's just hilarious to me because it's like, this is what he wants. This is what he loves. And it's just everything else is, I really want to smash my like sledgehammer like fist into you. When can I get to that?
And this also brings me to, it's a question I want to ask you in a minute, which is, what was your favorite episode? But I kind of have to tell you about mine first, because my favorite episode was episode 8, which is the fifth childhood flashback episode, which really just focuses on, there's not really much Matt in the episode at all. It's so heavy. It's called Shadows in the Glass. We've got these great flashbacks to Fisk's childhood where he's killing his father, but it's also these scenes where he's playing opera in his house and making his omelette and garnishing it just perfectly. And
The way they repeat that sequence, and then at the end when Vanessa does it, and you get the sense that she's disrupted his routine and it's made him a better person. And like, so you can sort of see how their relationship works, because he trusts her, you know, to alter him.
And I love the way that that relationship is written. I was looking forward to scenes with those two together.
Yeah, definitely. Like, the thing I like about Vanessa is how she plays it as sort of intrigued by Fisk rather than like seduced by him. Like, she doesn't see the power. She sees like the drive.
It led me to the point where at the end of that episode, I ended up taking a little bit of a gap between episode 8 and 9 after, like, I think I watched the first 4 on the first day and the second 4 on the second day. And it actually took me a couple of days to get back to it just because, you know, busy with other stuff. But I was at that point going, I kind of want Kingpin to win. And not win in a way that he destroys Matt Murdock, and that's that. But I kind of was like, hey, Matt, could you take down Owlsley, and could you take down those characters and leave Fisk to what he's doing? So like, he can ascend to be the legitimate kingpin of crime, and you can ascend to be Daredevil, and then, you know, deal with each other later.
Yeah, I was surprised that they ended the series with Kingpin being arrested, because I got the impression that this was going to be about their rise in tandem.
Yeah, but I feel like that, at least on a character level, the rise for Kingpin was acknowledging that he was a villain and acknowledging the means that he would have to embrace in the future. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if by the time we get back to a second season, Kingpin might be in jail, but his influence has not waned.
Well, and yeah, quite.
When he comes out of jail, he has an empire just to step back into and rule. That wouldn't surprise me whatsoever.
Yeah, and he's got a sort of nemesis whose life he might want to destroy in the same way his life got taken apart.
I was going to save that for the end, but Born Again would be a fantastic season 2, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would.
It seems to me to make so much sense, especially when you are dropping a season 2 of Daredevil in before The Defenders, which they might not have always had the plan to do. You know, you don't want to knock off your plans for what you had for.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The Defenders TV show. Mm-hmm. So you could do a self-contained Daredevil arc that is perfect within its own length, but doesn't mess up those plans. Oh, Born Again would be great. James, did you have a favourite episode?
It would probably be the Kingpin one as well, but in the interest of, you know, having an interesting discussion, I would say my second favourite is probably Nelson versus Murdoch.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I know the sort of backstory of the characters.
That's fun. That's really fun.
Yeah, it's great fun. But aside from the wigs, like Eldon Henson can put as many wigs on as he likes. You're never going to believe that this 37-year-old man is in his 20s. But on the other hand, like, I love all the hairstyles he goes through and the facial hair and how he gradually goes from like this sort of stoner, you know, Foggy Nelson into the lawyer Foggy Nelson by the end of it. And I love both how that episode sets up their friendship, even as it's taking it apart in the present day. And I think to do that with such economy, like, I think that is probably the best written episode just as a single entity. Like, if you wanted to sell anyone on Daredevil, you could pick that one and say this is the core of those characters, and this is how smart the writing can be as well, because, you know, you don't see a lot of them together, and certainly are not a lot of them having fun together, but by the end of that episode you really feel bad that this friendship has fallen apart.
Yeah, what's interesting though, and I am firmly with you on everything you've just said, but I feel like a lot of people reacted negatively to Foggy. A lot of people online seemed to find him irritating rather than charming, and thought that he wasn't kind of reflective of the Foggy in the comics. But I really liked that performance. I thought he brought the right amount of levity. And in fact, I thought that was kind of one of the contributing factors to the show being a little bit relentless in the last couple of episodes, was that
he was a bit more miserable and less in it.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And like, Karen and Foggy don't always have the most interesting things to do, because when Daredevil is going around doing his daredeviling and investigating Fisk and getting closer to finding out his identity or getting closer to taking him down, it always feels that what Foggy and Karen are doing is kind of like a couple of episodes behind. It's like, well, Matt achieved that a few episodes back. I'm not sure what you going and helping out this woman in her apartment is going to do, other than keeping you on screen and occasionally making the tone a little bit lighter.
I did get a bit of a season 2 Willow and Xander vibe from there, like, oh, we'll just look through some papers while the hero's out punching people and getting answers.
Yeah, but I liked them. I liked the performances. I would like to have seen a little bit more of them. A little bit more of them actually contributing to plot. Because, like, when Karen's off investigating Fisk killing his father, and I'm like, well, I mean, that's all well and good, you finding that out. But, like, if you put that information out there, what's it going to...
Yeah, that was a bit of a misstep, wasn't it, with the entire plot? Because eventually they just have Carrie to say to her, like, what do you think this will achieve? Like, it's useless to us. And I think, to be fair, it undersells Karen as a character that she believes so hard in this obviously useless information.
Yeah, yeah.
I just quickly, I want to mention how Foggy as a character, the depiction of Foggy is quite different to the comics. Like, in the source material, he's a lot more sort of bumbling and nerdy. Yeah. He's certainly not a wisecracker. But at the same time, the thing they kept was that he's just sort of affable enough that when he busts out his, like, lawyer skills, you're really impressed. And one of the things I love in the comics is when Foggy Nelson goes into a courtroom and just demolishes someone. And they did that sort of thing a couple of times in this series, like, especially when he talks to Marcy, aside from the fact that he unnecessarily insults her appearance,
the bit where he basically
takes her apart, you know, from a legal standpoint. Yeah, I enjoyed that scene.
And it kind of does make up for the lack of Matt lawyering. Because I liked Matt in court. Like, I loved his closing statement at the end of episode 3. I was like, oh, yeah, this is fun alter ego stuff. Like, this guy actually, there is a take on this superhero in the other side of his life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because the MCU doesn't have a bunch of characters who have alter egos. No, we've got Thor, and Iron Man and Captain America, and they are always Thor and Iron Man and Captain America.
Yeah.
You know, they're always those characters. So it was like an interesting twist, and it's something that I'm not sure we've seen many alter egos on screen recently, because, you know, like the X-Men don't have them. Probably it's been limited to Spider-Man.
Spider-Man and Superman are the classic secret identity characters, and Daredevil was essentially just Stan Lee saying, oh, we want Bill Everett to draw some comics, let's make a Spider-Man clone, and that's where Daredevil came from, so...
What did you think of this within the MCU?
What I liked was how they used the sort of destruction from the Avengers as the motivating factor. Because, like, when Daredevil was created, Hell's Kitchen was a bad part of Manhattan. And now the idea of a bad part of Manhattan just seems ridiculous.
Yeah, that's really smart. That's
that is smart.
That's really good.
Like, that's using continuity as a precision tool. At the same time, the tone is so different that the times they do mention other MCU characters, like when you get Wesley sort of mocking people for the gangsters for not being beaten by someone with a magic hammer and suit and stuff. Yeah. I just feel like they're in those sort of references are in there for the audience rather than the characters, and it just brings you out of the moment, really.
I'm kind of glad you said that, because, I mean, we've been agreeing too much. I love that this is part of the MCU, and I love that it is tonally feels so different from the rest of the MCU that we know, because I think it's something that will benefit this world later in the run. You've certainly got a lot of films that feel very similar tonally. Like, I like that this exists within the MCU, but it's separate. They'll give you a couple of winks and nods and reminders, but it, for me, as distracting as a line like that may feel, I thought it was almost just a nice reminder that, hey, this stuff is happening, and it's happening in the world of the MCU. And this is not the shit that Iron Man is going to fly down from Avengers Tower to have a look at. Someone else needs to be dealing with this stuff. Because I bet if Iron Man met Wilson Fisk, he'd go like, oh, yeah, he's pumping money into this economy. I'm certainly not going to spend any time worrying about him.
On that point, though, it bothered me because there were some other references to other characters. Like, you had Ben Urich had, say, the Hulk headlines on his wall and stuff. Like, when Claire is talking to Matt about his powers, she never says, like, oh, so are you one of those superheroes they have now? And it just sort of, it seems like it's hindering the show as much as it's helping it. Like, if it was explicitly its own continuity, you wouldn't be worried that she hadn't brought it up. It certainly helps the MCU more than it helps the show.
Yeah, but I do wonder whether further down the line it will help Daredevil. And also, you know, it establishes the idea that this already exists in a shared universe. So when Jessica Jones and Luke Cage and Iron Fist turn up, you won't bat an eyelid at that.
Do you think they're going to keep these shows in their own cul-de-sac, though, or whether they're going to turn up in, like, Infinity War or something?
I'm firmly of the belief that by the time we get to Infinity War, any character who has ever shown up in the MCU who is either alive, dead, from a TV show, from a current TV show, ex-TV show, will have some form of cameo across those two films. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if the Defenders, depending on, you know, if they stay in this realm of successfulness, have a decent sized role in
this. Is where we go back to the tone of Daredevil, though, because can you imagine, with all respect to the MCU films, which I love, they are aimed at children as much as adults. So can you have Daredevil turning up in Infinity War alongside the Avengers when his TV show is basically 13 episodes of a guy getting cut to ribbons?
Yeah, I absolutely think you can, because you just commit to the tone of the property that you're in. I think Daredevil could show up in a Spider-Man film, but Daredevil would not be able to be crushing skulls in that. He would have to adhere to the rules of the show that he's in. And I don't see any reason why that character can't show up and exist within the tone of the rest of the MCU. And, you know, it doesn't mean that he's not still doing all that other stuff while he's off in his own adventures. I honestly think if he showed up in Civil War for a scene or two, how good would it be if in Civil War we just hear, oh, and this guy in Hell's Kitchen has just had his identity revealed, and we go, what? And it turns out that Born Again is happening. Mm-hmm. That would be great.
No, I completely agree. I would love it, but I'm thinking more as a studio. Like, if you're the branding guy going, like,
yeah,
can we put Daredevil next to Captain America? Like, oh, try and find a picture where he's not got his gash down the side of his head or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can. Let's talk about one of the talking points we've got is Rosario Dawson and her character. And I mean, I think you were curious as to why she's in it so little.
Yeah, it seemed to me like they were setting her up as like essentially another female lead.
Well, episode two is all.
Yeah, episode two spends so, like, I love that episode, like, especially the way they really take their time to develop that relationship by doing sort of these long conversational two-handers that just on network television would have been sliced up.
Which is something the show commits to the whole way through, long scenes, whether that's the fight scene, which there's no point talking about the corridor fight scene.
Yeah, it's been done.
Everyone's acknowledged that that's awesome. But also, yeah, just 6, 8, 10 minutes of two characters stuck in a room talking to each other. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like, I love that. I love that stuff. And after that episode, I just sort of felt like they would bring her into it more, and now it seems more like she's been put in that world so she can turn up and help other superheroes in different Netflix series.
Yes, that would be my guess. I would guess that she's probably signed up for like a season's worth of television, like a 13 hours, maybe
yeah,
10 hours.
Okay.
Because there's that episode, it's very conspicuous, where it's at the start of Nelson versus Murdoch. He goes, oh, your friend Claire was just here, now she's gone. And she shows up in the next episode, but not in that one.
And the thing about that episode as well, the last time Matt and Claire spoke, they basically argued and weren't talking again. And then she appears off camera, patches him up and disappears again. And it's sort of like, you see why they're doing it, especially if the episode has to focus on Nelson and Murdoch. Like, they, you know, you don't need that scene with Claire in an episode that's not about Claire.
And she's very, I mean, Rosario Dawson's great. My theory on that would be, essentially, you know, Claire is looking after that flat for a friend whose cat she is looking after. Essentially, that would be Jessica Jones's flat, and that Claire is good friends with Jessica Jones. And Claire's ex-boyfriend is Luke Cage, who she introduces to Jessica Jones. And that she's almost like a bridging mechanism across the show. So yes, she could then show up to look after Luke or Jessica when they're hurt. And then presumably, you know, Luke is friends with the Iron Fist in the comics, I think. So presumably she would have a link to that as well.
Yeah, you know, it would make sense to have. Like, I was surprised that they went for that direction, because I was completely expecting a love triangle between
Matt and Foggy and Karen. Yeah.
And while they kind of did elements of that, like, you do get the sense that Karen's not interested in Foggy because she's more interested in Matt, but only in very vague terms.
It wasn't the story they wanted to tell in the show.
I mean, which is fair enough, because, like, not every female character has to be attracted to Charlie Cox.
Yeah, even if all of the audience is. I certainly was. Can we talk about Ben Urich? Because this was another interesting use of a character. So Ben Urich shows up, and I think notably, you know, Vondi Curtis Hall, who plays him, is an African-American man. So Ben Urich in this telling is black, and Ben is a character who in Daredevil and Spider-Man comics that I've read, I have really enjoyed, particularly Daredevil comics though.
Yeah, a kind of investigative muckraker who, you know, he goes for the stories and then he's got the ethics to follow them through or not in some cases.
Yeah, and I thought he was used economically at first, but, you know, increasingly well as the show went on. And I actually thought the final showdown with Kingpin was a particularly effective scene, because I'd really grown to like Ben, and this scene I thought had that added level of shock, because it was kind of the first time where I'm like, I know the source material, I'm pretty sure that Ben is safe. And then Kingpin strangles him to death, and it's a fantastic, again, one of those fantastic two-handed scenes, and the shock of what happens is palpable. But at the same time, we're 12 episodes into a TV show where they've introduced this really great black character and killed him. So it's kind of like recasting a white character as black, but then making him expendable.
I mean, one of the things that was great about Ben Urich was that he didn't let being, like, he wasn't race swapped in order for his race to define him.
No.
Like, he was in every way Ben Urich. He just happened to be played by a black actor. You know, there are people who complain, you know, we've covered this before about whether Peter Parker can be played by a black actor or not. And the Marvel Universe was created in the 60s by a bunch of white guys. So obviously all their leads and characters are predominantly white. So it's fine to swap it around a bit to be more reflective of modern attitudes.
I just thought it was so, like, I can just imagine the disappointment of watching Daredevil and thinking, oh, I mean, I don't really have to imagine it. The disappointment of watching Daredevil and thinking, oh, great, this comic book white character has been replaced by a black guy. It hasn't changed the character at all. And he's a likable, awesome, really good character. and he's going to be around on screen in the Marvel Cinematic Universe going forward. And
I mean, I do wonder if it's one of the ways that the Netflix model hurts things, because obviously all of these shows were written and filmed in advance, whereas if this had been a week to week thing, people would have gone, oh, you know, actually Ben Urich is really landing with the audience, let's not kill, you know, let's not waste the trump card of killing him for shock value.
Yeah,
like on one side you get the authorial intent stays intact of this character you love is brutally and shockingly killed. On the other hand, it would be better for the series as a whole if it stayed alive.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the great things I think about network TV is the way that the authors can respond to the fans almost in real time.
Mm-hmm.
One of the last things I want to ask you before we indulge in a little bit of speculation about season two. One of the things that struck me, I say this kind of reluctantly because I really love the pacing of maybe individual episodes here, but I couldn't help but feeling by the time I came to the end of 13 Hours of Daredevil that they had told maybe 7 to 10 hours of story across those 13 hours. I mean, it's very deliberately paced, so I understand that, but I'm not sure it needed to be 13 hours, and I certainly felt that come the last two or three episodes, there was a bit of a quality dip. I don't know if you felt that.
I did. I got the sense that the last three episodes were kind of just playing out as we'd expect. I found the last episode in particular was very rushed, and I sort of thought the plot-wise, the investigation didn't really dovetail into the ending that we got. Like, the idea that one guy could bring down the Kingpin when he owns most of the police doesn't really work for me. And, like, throughout the series, I was like, how are they going to arrest the Kingpin when all the police are crooked? And it turns out they just went to one guy who wasn't, and apparently that's enough.
Yeah. And I also thought, just in, like, in terms of, we spoke, you know, we briefly mentioned that corridor fight at the start, and I thought the action in the, like, first few episodes, I think a couple of people might have been put off by some of the ninja stuff in the middle, but I really liked that as well. I thought it was a cool way of, like, slowly introducing more comic booky.
I mean, I love the comic booky mythology stuff of Daredevil, so as much of that they can put in, the better.
Yeah, so when Stick turns up, that's a great episode.
Yeah, I love that one.
I mean, because I basically thought 5 through 10 was like the show, you know, hitting everything. 1 through 4 was good, but it really stepped up 5 through 10, and then after that kind of fell off. So even the action, like, there is a kind of like parkour scene in episode 12 where Daredevil is running across roofs, and he's awful.
It's a bit much, isn't it? There are bits where he does like sideways flips when he could just be leaping over something. It's a bit
but it's not shot well, and it's very obviously a stunt double, and there is no kind of like, you don't feel like he's zipping across rooftops. It's like he's jogging. And Stephen Estenite directed that finale, and I thought the fight between Kingpin and Matt, especially Kingpin and Daredevil, especially given you talking about how great it was when he gleefully smashed Daredevil's face in at the end of was that episode 9, I think.
Yeah. It's the ninja episode, isn't it?
It felt really flat. Just what? Oh, so we're just ending in an alleyway with these two guys fighting, and like the invention that there was earlier on.
The like final blow is a kind of slow motion hammered drop on Kingpin's face. It's kind of what I would have liked to have seen is, instead of the kind of trailing investigation at the end, is more stuff in the courtroom towards the end, because that's what I felt really was lacking. Like, Daredevil is half lawyer, and if he's not doing actual lawyering in the finale, I think that's a problem.
Should we talk about what we would like to see in season two, because I think it ties quite nicely into that. I mean, we've mentioned that wouldn't it be great if they did Born Again, because I think it's particularly the world and the tone they've established here, Born Again would fit really seamlessly into this. But I would really like the idea that if you're going to do 13 episodes, like maybe 3 or 4 episodes, because this season kind of has like a, it's, you have to kind of wrangle it into it a little bit, but it kind of has a 3-act structure in the way a movie does, but just very, very slowly paced. I would like the idea of maybe doing the first 4 or 5 episodes of Daredevil season 2 to be just Daredeviling around Hell's Kitchen, maybe taking on some like fun villain of the week. Yeah, take on some villain of the weeks. Maybe Owlsley returns. But like, and if you want to do Bullseye, if you want to introduce Bullseye or Elektra, introduce them for an episode and have one little adventure with that character, and he goes off, and that he's doing his lawyering by day and his daredeviling by night. But have the stuff going on in the background of, you know, Fisk strings is, being pulled by Kingpin, and then dive into that story. And I think you could do a really nice mix in Daredevil of story of the week added, you know, that's the one thing that I would have liked a little bit more of here. And I think there would be a potential to do that.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird because one of the things I didn't like about Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. for the first half of the first series was their over-reliance on, like, story of the week plots. And yet, I think if it was done right in the kind of Buffy style,
yes,
Daredevil would be a perfect fit for it.
And we've got, I mean, we now know that Stephen S. DeKnight is not returning to showrun the second season. Instead, we've got Doug Petrie.
I kind of get the feeling that Stephen DeKnight has actually gone on to develop Defenders, and that's okay. Why he's not, like, there's no announcement of that. It's just a sort of feeling of if I was Netflix, what would I be doing right now? And I'd be taking the critical hit and giving the end game to that guy.
Yeah, that's a very good idea. It does seem interesting that DeKnight's like, I have prior commitments, but I can't tell you what they are.
Yeah.
But generally, I mean, I felt myself waning through the last three episodes of Daredevil, feeling that it kind of ran out of steam a little bit. Having said that, the pieces are there, particularly Charlie Cox and Vincent D'Onofrio, to make me very keen for more of this.
Yeah, even as the writing sort of struggles towards the end, it kind of coasts by in the performances, really, doesn't it? Like, all of those characters, the ensemble is so strong in every regard that you can forgive when it gets a bit fluffy towards the end.
Okay, well, I think that is it for this bonus episode. Get ready for the usual spiel. If you're enjoying the show, then please do subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Player FM, or your podcast app of choice. And if you've already subscribed, then please leave us a rating or review and we will give you a shout out on a future show. You can find episodes of Cinematic Universe on cinematicuniverse.libsyn.com, panelbeats.co.uk, or, as we're a Film Divider podcast, at filmdivider.com. You can get in touch via Facebook, on Twitter, at @CU_podcast, or send us an email to cinematicuniversepod@gmail.com. I'll be back this time next week with a mini-sode featuring my reactions to Seven James's Age of Ultron comic book recommendations and to Charlie Cox's Daredevil recommendation, which is really cool. and we will have a bumper crop of superhero movie news by that point as well. See you next week.
Goodbye.
It's said that the West was built on legends, and that legends are a way of understanding things greater than ourselves. Forces that shape our lives, events that defy explanation, individuals whose lives soar to the heavens or fall to the earth. This is how legends are born. Cinematic Universe returns in 2 weeks' time with Ghost Rider.